you tuned to yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark LeVillier. In this hour, true history with an interesting recording, part variety and much history. It's the White House Correspondents' Association dinner that was recorded and planned for broadcast, though never aired. According to information from the White House Correspondents' Association, its first dinner was held in 1920, with the first president attending 4 years later. That was Calvin Coolidge. Up until the Second World War, the annual dinner was known as an entertainment extravaganza, bringing in the big stars and musicians of the day with closing remarks by the president. It was an evening meant to honor all of the reporters who were at the White House day in and day out, letting the public know the goings-on in Washington. In the next hour, we'll hear an abbreviated version of the recording made on March 4, 1944, for the Correspondents' Dinner, an evening which received some press itself. The next day, the Charlotte Observer wrote that, quote, "the most complete turnout of the nation's war leaders since Pearl Harbor ate unrationed duck and traded off-the-record political wisecracks with the Capitol's press last night at the annual dinner of the White House Correspondents' Association. President Roosevelt, attending the only party outside the White House that he allows himself in wartime, sang loud when the entertainers called for audience participation and laughed louder at some of the fourth-term jokes which flew thick all evening." Listen now to moments from the White House Correspondents' Association dinner, recorded on March 4, 1944.
Mr. President, members of the White House Correspondents' Association, and distinguished guests, to continue our evening of relaxation, it is my pleasure to introduce now a variety entertainment which the National Broadcasting Company has prepared, presenting a group of artists who have joined us from various corners of our 48 states, the ODT permitting, to tender their respects to you here this evening. This is a variety entertainment, a sort of an old-fashioned show. And we're going to follow with a program which includes everything from a famed, world-famed virtuoso to, yes, an animal act. Before we proceed, I would like to reintroduce the distinguished director of music of the National Broadcasting Company, who has been heard thus far throughout the evening and will stay with us and his musical men as our show progresses, Dr. Frank Black and the NBC Orchestra. In my job as master of ceremonies here this evening, I feel neither too masterful or very ceremonious. In fact, this is a rather new assignment to myself as a radio announcer, but we have it on the highest of authority. There is nothing to fear but fear, and so I shall plow on. An essential ingredient, we feel, of a heartwarming show is a bit of good song, well and warmly sung. And so, we of NBC are proud to present to you two young singers whose rise already has been meteoric in their field. First, a young man who used to pitch ball, semi-pro ball. The Dodgers almost had their hooks on him until his parents decided that he should sing a little more and a little more professionally. And so he studied, and in a few short years has won great fame and success. He is heard regularly on NBC Serenade to America. He's currently appearing at the Radio City Music Hall. We proudly present the young baritone, Robert Merrill. Here he is. And a lovely young lady from Los Angeles. She has sung with great success in Cincinnati and in Cleveland. You hear her now on the Concert Hour. We're going to ask our mezzo-soprano, Nan Merriman, to step forward.
My heart is aching for someone, and you are that someone. You are the truth of my story. You must believe what you see.
I too must find one to love me.
Thank you, man. Nan Merriman and Robert Merrill, a great international artist, a favorite of the English Music Hall and a true exponent of the spirit of Hands Across the Sea artistically and musically. I know that you'll be very glad to welcome the one and only Gracie Fields. Frank, let's have pomp and circumstance.
I'm going to start off with a little song which I call England's Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, only we say, I'm going to see you today, all swept with my world. And the people that I meet as I hurry down the street seem to know I'm on my way, coming to you. This is a beautiful day. I'm walking on air, and my feet have taken to wings. My heart with happiness sings. I'll soar.
Gentlemen, by very popular request, I think I echo your feelings, Miss Fields, to sing the greatest aspidistra in the world.
I think most of you know what an aspidistra is now, but in case there's anyone who doesn't, it is like the rubber plant over here, only we call ours an aspidistra. For years we had an aspidistra in a flower pot on the whatnot near the axe stand in the hall. It didn't seem to grow till one day our brother Joe had a notion that he'd make it strong and tall. So he's crossed it with an acorn from an oak tree, and he's slanted it against the garden wall. It shot up like a rocket till it's nearly reached the sky. It's the biggest aspidistra in the world. We couldn't see the top of it. It got so blooming high. It's the biggest aspidistra in the world. When Father's had a snootful at his pub's a bunch of grapes, he doesn't go all fighting mad and throwing up the grapes. You'll find him in his bathing suit playing Tarzan of the Apes up the biggest aspidistra in the world. The Tomcats and their sweethearts love to spend their evenings out up the biggest aspidistra in the world. They all begin meowing when the buds begin to sprout from the biggest aspidistra in the world. The dogs all come around for miles, a lovely sight to see. They sniff around for hours and hours and wag their tails with glee. So I've had to put a notice up to say it's not a tree, it's the biggest aspidistra in the world. My brother's in the army. He's in the home defense with the biggest aspidistra in the world. The colonel says that's topping. Now we'll start the big advance with the biggest aspidistra the world. Then Goring saw it from afar and said to his old frau, young Joe has got his temper up, the war's all over now, for they're going to sing old Hitler from the very highest bough of the biggest aspidistra in the world.
I'd like to introduce a very lovable guy. He is the creator, the central character of one of radio's newest and most delightful programs. Just as Washington has its Occidental Cafe and New York its Diddy Moore's, all America has by radio its Duffy's Tavern, which is a... That's right, Duffy's. A sawdust-strewn bistro where the elite meet to greet. Duffy's is run by an irascible Irishman named Duffy, mostly by telephonic communication. He places all of the responsibilities of the joint in the hands of a very amiable and ingenious lad named Archie. Archie is the creation of one of the most original and talented of our radio stars. I'm happy to present him. Ed Gardner as Archie of Duffy's Tavern.
Hello. Well, this, you know, I just said to John Royal, this is the toughest spot in the world. You know, you go on there after that Gracie Field. But I'm very happy to be here. You know, the other day when John called up and said, I want you to go down to Washington, you know, to the thing. I said, well, gee, this is wonderful. So I right away, you know, I go call my mother on the phone. I say, geez, Mom, I'm going down there and Roosevelt's going to be there, everything, you know. So, you know, and it's all a big hit with the family. We got on relief once, you know. And so anyway, I'm terrifically thrilled by it all. And I go back to the house and I saw I'm bragging about the thing. And the morning, the dame comes in, the maid, you know. And I say to her, Dorothy, good morning, Dorothy. I say, Dorothy, did you ask me what I'm going to be doing Saturday night? She says, no, sir. I said, Dorothy, are you sure you didn't ask me what I'm going to be doing Saturday night? She said, I didn't say a word. I said, Dorothy, ask me what I'm going to be doing Saturday night. She said, what are you doing Saturday night, Mr. Gardner? I said, I am going down to Washington to entertain the President of the United States of America. She says, that's a nice trip. What kind of cereal do you want this morning? Well... So anyway, I tried to figure out. I didn't know what to do down here, you know, because in this radio racket, I'm not an old vaudeville guy with a stock routine or anything, but if you guys would like to hear about the two-headed guy, you know, that two-top Gruskin, which you might have heard on the air, and you want to... Well, you know, that's the reason Duffy couldn't get down here tonight. We wanted to have him down, but he's busy with the ball club, you know. We got this... ball club at Duffy's, the D-A-A-I-Y, Duffy's All-American Irish Yankees. And Duffy's the manager, you know. He discovered this two-top Gruskin, the greatest pitcher that ever lived. It's funny how it come about, you know. Duffy, one day, he says to Dugan, his shortstop, he says, Dugan, we got a great ball club here, but it lacks color. He says, what's the answer? So Dugan says, color, eh? He says, I don't know whether this is it or not, Duffy, but I think I know where I can lay my hands on a pitcher with two heads. So, Duffy says, I don't know, you think it'd be a novelty? Dugan says, well, what if it ain't? Where can you get a guy can watch first and third at the same time? So Duffy says it's an angle. He says, besides, the guy'd probably be great for double headers. So he says, what's his name, Dugan? So Dugan tells him, he says his name is Athos and Porthos McGinnis. However, they call him Two-Top Gruskin for short. So Duffy says, Two-Top, what a funny nickname. Wonder why they call him that. So Dugan says, I don't know, maybe on account of two heads. Duffy says, ridiculous, isn't it? So he says, where's he from? He says, he's from Walla Walla, naturally. So anyhow, the guy comes down to Duffy's, you know. I see him the night he comes down to sign a contract at the ball club. You know, he's all dressed up formal in a tuxedo, you know, so... You know, naturally, not joint. Everybody stares at the guy, you know. So he turns his two heads to the crowd, and he says, what are you staring at? None of you guys ever see a tuxedo before? Oh. Duffy's a diplomat. He quick covers the embarrassment. He says, waiter, bring the gentleman a couple of beers. So he says to the guy, he says, stick around, so Top. He says, you know, you might have a little fun around here tonight. It was the night we were having the annual masquerade, you know, the St. Patrick's masquerade. So he says, stick around. The funny thing, the guy wins first prize in the masquerade. He comes as a pair of bookends. Yeah, with a book between his two heads, you know. Little book his mother gave him called My Son, My Son. Anyways, after they give him the prize up, he says, look, so Top, I'm a man of few words. Report tomorrow morning's uniform and two caps waiting for you in the locker room. So he got out there, but there was right away trouble. You see, we had this catcher, a guy named Gorilla Hogan. A catcher on the ball club, natural born catcher, stands 6 feet, 14 inches high, and he squats standing up. You know, a behemoth, you know? So, anyways, the trouble starts, you see, in the first game, the gorilla signals for a fast curve, you see? Gives him the signal, so the two-headed guy nods one head yes and shakes the other head no. Which is very confusing to the gorilla, you know? He ain't a very bright guy anyhow. Even for a gorilla. So, he makes a beeline for Duffy. He says, Duffy, I'm a little sick and tired of two-headed pitchers around this ball club. He says, I think I gotta get off the team. So Duffy says, no, wait a minute. Don't get excited. Go over and talk it over with the guy. After all, three heads is better than one. So the gorilla says, no, he says, Duffy, you can't do it. I just got a feeling the guy ain't quite normal. He says, besides, I don't trust him. He says, you watch the guy. He says, you always get them two heads together. You're gonna have a strike on your hands before. So, Duffy, you know, finally had to accede to the thing, you know. Hey, that's a good word, huh? So, anyhow, Duffy has to fire the guy, you know, and it was sad, you know, that when he told him he had to go, the lumps come up in the guy's throat, you know. So, but he was pretty game. He took it, but he was kind of sad. He's happy now. He went back to his old job, watching tennis matches for Pathé News. Well, so that's the end of Sosa.
Ready, take a bow. Eddie Archie Gardner is going to consult via the electric telephone with Mr. Duffy, and maybe he'll rejoin us in just a moment. I'd like to introduce now a favorite American radio personality and American institution. He has arrived in Washington only about 20 minutes ago by airplane from a cross-country hop, following his appearances in the United States and overseas in Algeria, Tunis, Iceland. In fact, he's marked A1 with the ATC. Where there's life, there is Bob Hope.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to get on. I can't follow that introduction. Thank you. But I'm very happy to be here. How are the boys in the gutter doing? How are you doing? All right, men? I'm very honored to be here. I'm very thrilled. It's a privilege and it's an honor. And it's a free meal. I want to tell you, I'm really a little late. I was supposed to come out here and go through this show, but I'm a little late. I had a little trouble getting out of the cab. I was on the bottom layer. And it's a thrill to be here at this dinner. I've been waiting for this long enough, believe me. I thought this invitation would never come. I thought it was vetoed by Barclay or something. I never realized. I want to tell you. Of course. I guess I shouldn't say, mention album in front of our president. That's like talking to Crosby about Sinatra. But I do want to say,
I do want to say it's a great thrill being here. I just arrived by plane, flew through some fancy mud to get here. But I wouldn't miss it for the world. I made a few notes here. I've got a lot of eggs pulled together here. And remind me to take home a piece of cake for this benefit. I must take a piece of cake to my agent, if you don't mind. Remind me that, will you, please? I do that for my agent, you know, because this is a benefit, and I must take his commission home, so be sure I get that. I've played so many benefits in the past couple of years, I'm benefit happy. The other morning at home, I came downstairs, I said to my man, I said, I'll have two eggs and toast, and it's a great pleasure to be here tonight. I have agents for everything, believe me, I do. In Hollywood, that's all you see are the agents. The town is filled with agents. I could never understand how 95% of the people out there could live on 10% of what the other 5% hope to make sometime. But it's really a great pleasure to be here in Washington, D.C. After arriving, I found out what the D.C. means. Damn confused. But I do want to say, it's really great, and I finally found a place to sleep. I finally found a place. You know the Shoreham Hotel, that beautiful place out there? My bench overlooks it. That is the big problem here, trying to find a place to sleep. I finally went into the Carlton Hotel, and they didn't have any rooms, so I went down, the lobby was filled, and I went down in the cellar, and there was a fellow sleeping on a cot. I said, isn't this terrible? I think I'll go to another hotel. He says, don't be silly. You can't. I'm the manager of the staff, and look at me. They finally did get me a hot little spot. I have a nice little place over here, a little hotel. I'm very lucky. I'm on the same floor with a washroom, and I do want to tell you, this morning it was very rough. There were 75 guys lined up in front of the washroom. Some senator inside holding a filibuster. A filibuster that's Mersey Dotes without music. Trying to find a room in Washington is like trying to find my day in the Chicago Tribune. But I do want to tell you, I mean it sincerely. It's really tough. I passed the Lincoln Memorial out here today, and there's five secretaries living in Lincoln's lap. Believe me, it's really rough. And by the way, about the women, I hear there are six women for every man here in Washington. Is that true? Some guy must have 12 tonight. But it's a great town, isn't it? And everybody, almost everybody's interested in politics. I saw one of the lights on the corners there, one of the signal lights, light up today, and it said, walk, Republicans. I'll say a lot of things I'll be sorry for tomorrow. And, of course, there's so much business being done in Washington that things naturally move slowly in Washington. I understand that Washington right now is 3 weeks behind Drew Pearson. Is there any truth to that? But I'm really thrilled. One reason I've always envied you fellas in the newspaper business, I've always envied writers, because it's a wonderful thing. I mean, just think, like Claire Booth Luce, she wrote a play and now she's in Congress. Isn't that wonderful? I understand Gypsy Rose Lee is writing a play. I hope she's elected to Congress. I'd like to see her put a motion before the House. That would really be grand. But you'll never know what a great thrill it is to be here in the same room with President Roosevelt. I mean that. It's a great thrill because I've always loved President Roosevelt, and my father always loved President Roosevelt. That's the truth. In fact, when I was born, he said, Bob, someday you may grow up to be vice president. That'll just give you an idea. I've said a lot of things. I do want to apologize, President Roosevelt, for some of the things I've said on the air about Mrs. Roosevelt. But Mrs. Roosevelt is such a wonderful copy. Like, for instance, I told a joke a few months ago about President Roosevelt and Mr. Churchill conferring on war strategy. Probably should never have said that. I said war strategy meant where and when should we attack the enemy and how we keep Eleanor out of the crossfire. I mean, those I promise to be more careful in the future. My program's a little impaired this season. I've lost a few fellas to General Hershey. They got skinny in it, you know. They took him. They wanted to release a whack for active duty, and they took... Got a good job, though. They're using him to clean rifles. I must tell you, he scared the hell out of him down when he went down for his physical. He walked in the doctor's office. He took off his clothes. The doctor took one look and went outside and lowered the flag. Skinny says, "Doc, I don't think I'll make it. I got bad eyes." The doctor says, "Look, we don't examine eyes anymore. We just count them now." Said, "You got bad eyes. We'll put you up front where you can see everything." Then he took a sample of Skinny's blood, he thought. Stuck the needle in, he waited for about 10 minutes. And he slapped Skinny in the face and said, "When we want hot water, we'll ask for it." I went down for my physical just before I left Hollywood. They asked me in such a way I couldn't refuse. And I went down. I walked in, the nurse said, "Take off your clothes and camphor bag." And I took off all my clothes. Took off all my clothes, and I stood there, and I said, "Well, Doc, what's cooking?" He said, "With a pot like you've got, it could be a 7-course dinner." Then he tapped me on the knee, and my pivot tooth fell out. But I wish you could have seen those people down at that physical. Oh, what odds and ends. I'll tell you, it's really amazing. They're really getting down to the bottom of the barrel. In fact, they're starting to scrape a little now. They don't even ask your age anymore. They just hand you a copy of Esquire and see what page you turn to. Thank you, readers. I also want to congratulate all the war correspondents, because I saw a lot of them this past year, and I want to tell you that they're covering more front than Dorothy L'Amour. I do want to tell you that, really. And you really stop comparing them there, because L'Amour has no deadline. It's really amazing. This past year, I happen to have the... You get them later or laugh longer? What do you do? This past year, I happened to have the privilege of entertaining a lot of our guys in the service, and I flew to England. Didn't bother me at all. Didn't scare me a bit. Flew right over. Read a novel on the way across. Coming back, I read the second page. But I do want to tell you, we had a grand trip, and everybody had a lot of fun on the plane. I know, because I looked inside and saw them. I'll never forget... We were halfway across the Atlantic, and the pilot turned around to me and said, "You a little nervous?" I said, "Yeah, this is only my third time up." He said, "You beat me, this is my first." I said, "It's a little rough out there. Don't you think we ought to have parachutes?" He said, "Don't be silly. The guys with parachutes jumped an hour ago." And it was so foggy, the birds were walking. I've never seen anything like it, really. But we finally got to England. You know, England, that's the place that Churchill visits when he leaves America. Well, we finally got back... I don't mean that. He's really a great man, and he really travels. He's been to Casablanca more than Humphrey Bogart. What a man. He just came back the last time to get a couple of towels that Wilkie took from Buckingham Palace. But I must say, you know who Wilkie is. That's the man that's got his eye on the president's chair. But look what President Roosevelt's got on him. I must say... You know, what I really get a kick out of, too, is the English people. They're marvelous over there. The English girls are great. They whistle back. They're marvelous. And the expressions are tremendous. The English expressions. I was out with a girl the first night I was there. I was with her about 10 minutes. And she said, "You're pulling my leg." And I hadn't even thought of it. I mean, up to that time. But they're great gals. And that killed me in the paper the other day, that soldier over there. It's just proving that there'll always be an England. But I want to tell you. I think that's the way to cement relations. I do want to tell you right now. There's a grand show coming on. And I don't have to tell you sincerely how thrilled I am to have had the pleasure to be here And I just want to say, before I go, that I must tell you this one note. I was traveling in a hospital in England, and we were going through one of the wards after our outside show, and I saw a fella in the corner bed with an MP guarding him. So I said to the colonel, I said, what's the trouble with this fella? He said, well, he's just one of those fellas that doesn't do anything right, goes AWL, shoots crap, won't eat his spam. He's just one of those fellas. So after we visited all the other beds, I finally got back to this chap, and I said, I've been talking to the colonel about you. What's the big idea, son? And he said, Mr. Hope, did you give a pint of blood to the Red Cross last year? And I said, yes. He said, shake hands with the guy that got it. Thank you. Goodbye. I have the extreme pleasure of introducing a lady now that I know is really going to thrill you, fellas, because I know you remember her as the sweetheart of the AES. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Elsie Janis, right here.
Thank you very much. That Hope man handles this thing. Did you notice it? I'm very glad to be here. I'm very glad that my dear old friend John Royal dug me up out of my nice California rut and had me get in a plane and fly to this party. Now that I'm here, I realize that I would take a much rougher trip and a much longer trip any time to see a certain party looking as swell as he does after 11 years run. Said my rut. I'm not really in a rut. I'm very, shall we say, active in this war, but I'm not leaping about entertaining the dear boys for the simple reason that I think they should have the kind of things they have, such wonderful people as Bob Hope, and incidentally, in the feminine line, I think they should have the 1944 model. I haven't any of that feeling about hearing there's life in the old girl yet. In the first place, I know there is, so I don't have to go out and show it to anybody. And in the second place, I'm taking no chance on their saying, so that's what the old man likes, is it? But I am, of course, very interested in them. My heart naturally is with them. And I hear from my husband, who is overseas, that this current army is doing just about the same with French as we did. I mean, they're still saying bonjour, vin rouge, combien, and comment te hallez-vous. And so I have translated one of the popular songs, and if I were doing any camp or, you know, army stuff, I'd do it like this. I'd do it the way one of our Texas fellas and then three French poilus might do it. In my arms, ain't I never gonna get a gal in my arms. In my arms, ain't I never gonna get a bundle of charms. Comes the dawn, I'll be gone. I just gotta have a honey holding me tight. You can keep your knitting and your purling if I'm going to get to Berlin. Give me a gal in my arms tonight. Dans mes bras, n'aurai jamais une petite femme dans mes bras. Dans mes bras, dans mes bras. N'aurai jamais un petit paquet plein de joie. Le jour vient et mon train m'emmènera loin d'ici et sera mon espoir. Avant que je m'en aille à la guerre, donnez-moi ce que me plaira. Une femme dans mes bras ce soir. Thank you. lots more coming, so we can't stall around. I have written a streamlined version of our old friend, Hinky Dinky Farley Bruce. I am afraid perhaps you gentlemen of, shall we say, a riper vintage may not understand it, but it's for the boys, and this is what I would say to them. Listen, you sons of my old friends. When your father talks of the days when he was far across the sea, in the land of wee-wee-wee, and a town called Gay Paris, when he brags about just how good he was in that 1918 show, then yes, him, lad, but say, listen, Dad, what I really want to know is, where was a place called Hinky Dinky Parley Voo? Where was that sector every Yankee soldier knew? Why is it after all of these years the veterans sing of arm and tears? And Hinky Dinky Parley Voo, then ask him, must I prepare for Hinky Dinky Parley Voo? Will the CO and non-coms have to face it too? What's that you say that in your day the general always led the way to Hinky Dinky Parley Voo? Then ask him, what did you do at Hinky Dinky Parley Voo? Can you remember all the things that you went through? I know you got the Croix de Guerre, but tell me, Dad, did you win a fair? At Hinky Dinky Parley Voo, then tell him you're gonna look for Hinky Dinky Parley Voo. You're gonna tell those jerks of Hitler's scram. You're through. Maybe she's not still Mademoiselle, but she'll help you give those nasties. Well, Hinky Dinky Parley Voo.
Now may I present to you a distinguished musician, creator of a popular style of singing which has made his name and his vocal ensemble and his radio performance a household word. I needn't say any more than the popular and well-loved Fred Waring.
Now, we have a number which we'd like all of you to join with us. You haven't been invited to sing all night, and we want you to sing with us the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Your part is quite simple. You all know the words. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. Will you give them the pitch and we'll let them get an idea? Glory, glory, hallelujah. That's what you do. You sing that three times. His truth is marching on. Now we'll see how much singing we can get out of this troop. I'm going to fight like the devil to get some singing out of you. Will you respond? After all, we're Americans. We all know it. Will you try? No? Will you really try? Let's hear how you'll try. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Come on.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
We got more than that out of a quartet. Try once more now. Come on.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Right, now, that's fine. Now, don't get excited and run away with it. Keep it nice and slow. And when we get to the spot, I'll turn around and lead you. And it'll be very exciting if you try. If you don't, we should have stayed in New York. All right.
Rounding out the dim, it's well.
I can read his righteous sentence in the dim and flaring lamp. His day is marching on.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on.
And thank you very much, NBC, for a grand show, and also our very great thanks to the Statler Hotel for putting on such a nice party. Now, gentlemen, please remain in your seats until the president has left the hall, and before he leaves, he's got a good night word for us. Gentlemen, this is off the record, the President of the United States.
My colleagues of many conferences. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for giving me a very wonderful evening of relaxation and of pleasure. This wonderful show that we've had left me with only one thought. We of the White House Correspondents Association still have something to do, to entertain our fellow citizens. And I think that if Dave Sarnoff were to come and teach us how to do it, we could have one of our conferences on the air in order that the public might enjoy our conferences as much as I do. Of course, these parties take me back many, many years. When George O'Connor led us tonight, it took me back to the days when he and I, after the late unpleasantness between the North and the South, were first elected to the House of Representatives. George and I became old, old friends, as we've remained ever since. And it is in a certain excellent place on Pennsylvania Avenue, near the foot of Capitol Hill, and far removed from the other end of Capitol Hill, when he taught me how to sing Saloon. That was the beginning. I had to be in Washington. And that's why I've come back so often since. It carries me back to the days of Uncle Ted, when there was no White House Correspondents Association, when there were a few people who drifted in occasionally, and Uncle Ted had his favorites. You don't know about it, you're too young. But he did. And he carries me back these many, many years, when there were so many of you that I had to build a new West Wing to the White House. And so the years have gone by, and I'm very happy to have been with you tonight. I wish that everybody could come to these parties, and that also we could translate some of our parties. Oh, not the kind with white ties and white waistcoats and stiff... stiff shirts. If we could translate our parties, because these are peculiarly our parties, to some of the fronts, way down into the southwestern Pacific, and up in the Aleutians, and across the ocean on the other side to Italy and Sicily and England. We've had some wonderful examples of great service out of uniform in this war. Bob Hope, the most popular American with the armed forces overseas today. And the good people who every day are going to the camps and the hospitals in this land and on the fighting front. We're grateful to them, and we're grateful to the other heroes, Ray, Mac, who are not with us this year, and many others who come back and tell us about things, and who, when they're on the other side, write the kind of stories that make people, more than any other thing, I think, realize what war is. And so, I am going to ask your permission, your president and your ex-president, to let me ask you to drink a little toast. A toast to the armed forces of the United States. Army, Navy, and Marines. And especially to those men who are serving at all the fighting fronts today. Gentlemen of the armed forces.
The White House Correspondents Association dinner, recorded by NBC and never broadcast on March 4th, 1944. And that brings to a close this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.